The shutdown ripples across the globe today, Wednesday, October 2nd. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama cancels a trip to Asia because of the shutdown, and fears rise over what happens if Washington misses its next deadline and fails to raise the debt ceiling.
Markets would become highly unstable because people would suddenly not know what kind of world they're in or how to price the future.
Also today, a Russian immigrant's first trip to the store.
It struck me as something absolutely surreal, not possible even to imagine. I counted 83 beers.
And making hip-hop in Addis Ababa.
MCs rapping in Swahili and French and English, you know, just kind of mashing up their styles.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The government shutdown continues, and it just took a bite out of U.S. diplomacy. President Obama has called off his visits next week to the Philippines and Malaysia. The White House says it's because of the federal shutdown in Washington. That's the third time that this president has canceled trips to Asia since he took office. And that's significant for an administration that says it wants to refocus American foreign policy on the Asia-Pacific region. I'm with The World's Matthew Bell, who's joined me in the studio. How big of a deal is this, Matthew?
Well, Marco, it's a big enough deal that President Obama himself got on the phone to call the heads of state of the Philippines and Malaysia and tell them, sorry, we have dysfunction in Washington, not going to be able to make it. He evidently did commit to visiting both countries before his term is out. A good reminder that these are two important places for the Obama administration. The Philippines is a longtime ally. It has close military relations, especially with the United States. Malaysia is seen as a moderate Muslim country with a commitment to electoral politics. So the cancellation will be seen there as somewhat of a disappointment.
Obama reassuring those leaders, it's not you, it's us. So when he spoke at the UN last week, we noticed that Obama's speech was almost exclusively devoted to crises in the Middle East, especially Iran and Syria. Is this yet another sign that the U.S. is just incapable of making that famous pivot to Asia and focusing on this region?
Not necessarily, Marco. I talked with one of President Obama's former top advisors on East Asia from the National Security Council, Jeffrey Bader, this morning. And he told me, on the contrary, in fact, President Obama is still going to Asia. He's got two big meetings coming up, one in Indonesia, one in Brunei. These are the APEC and the East Asia Summit meetings. He's going to be meeting with many, many heads of state there. As Bader told me, this was really the main purpose of this Asia visit this time around. And the fact that he's still going through with that is sending a message that the administration's priorities are on Asia and that the so-called pivot is underway, even if that's not the best word for it.
It is a problem in the sense that the U.S. government has to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. And when the U.S. government is shut down, it's hard to do either, frankly. But we can't forget the Middle East while we're concentrating on developing our presence in the Asia-Pacific region. That's why I think, frankly, the term pivot was not a great term. The term pivot suggests that we were going to be leaving behind the Middle East and concentrating on the Asia-Pacific region. I don't think that's an accurate metaphor.
So Bader told me here, Marco, that Obama is trying to thread the needle. He did not want to risk being seen traveling abroad, doing bilateral meetings by the American public at a time of real crisis back in Washington. At the same time, he wanted to show this commitment to rebalance, and that's the term that U.S. officials are using a lot more of, to rebalance U.S. efforts toward that part of the world. In contrast, Marco, Bill Clinton faced the exact same decision during his first term. Mm-hmm. There was a government shutdown. He had a trip to Asia planned. He canceled the whole thing.
So what's the reaction from Asia been to these cancellations?
From the Philippines and Malaysia so far, officials have been quoted as saying they completely understand the decision. I think behind the scenes, there's probably going to be some concern, especially when they look ahead at this debt ceiling issue. After all, China and Japan hold huge piles of U.S. debt, and now we're talking about the possibility that Congress could refuse to raise the debt ceiling and then risk a U.S. default.
The World's Matthew Bell there. We'll hear a lot more about the debt ceiling later in the program and why our government's ability to pay its debts matters big time to the global economy. First, though, we want to focus on another area of government potentially impacted by the federal shutdown in Washington, the resettlement of refugees, people from all over the globe who trust that America can protect them from war and persecution. The World's Jason Margolis has been checking in with some refugee resettlement agencies across the U.S.
When new refugees arrive in the United States, they come to a place like the Somali Development Center in Jamaica Plain, a neighborhood of Boston. The organization serves about 500 refugees and immigrants a year from the Horn of Africa. Abdi Raham Youssef is the executive director.
We are doing a lot of work for a very vulnerable population that does not get a lot of help and support. You know, help them get a job, help them get affordable housing, get the kids in the right schools, teach people English and acculturation issues.
Youssef gets money to do much of this from the state of Massachusetts, which receives its funding from the federal government. So I asked Youssef if the government shutdown affects his office. I'm not the only one asking.
A lot of people are asking me, what's going to happen? Is this office going to close? And, you know, creates uncertainty for people, yes.
Youssef reassures his clients, though, he doesn't expect much of an impact on operations. That is, if the shutdown only lasts a few days.
But yeah, who knows? How, you know, the whole idea and the tension is, I don't know.
I called the Massachusetts Office for Refugees and Immigrants to try and get some clarification. They send Youssef his checks. The chief of staff there suggested that I contact a federal administrator at the Office of Refugee Resettlement in Washington. So I sent an email and got an immediate response. It said, quote, I am out of the office on furlough and I am not able to read or respond to your message. This situation has left a lot of refugee resettlement agencies across the nation feeling a bit confused.
I think the impacts are kind of rippling out a little bit. We're learning a little bit more. Literally, it feels like as each hour passes.
Christina Bruce Bennion directs the Agency for New Americans in Boise, Idaho. Her organization works mostly with Iraqi, Congolese, and Somali refugees. She relies on a mix of funding sources and grants, which she says are mostly already allocated. But one of her key grants has now been suspended because of the shutdown.
I know there are several meetings going on, I think, in New York and D.C. today as they try to figure out, you know, what all the different pieces are that are being impacted. We did have actually an arrival come last night. So as we move through the usual things of applying for Social Security cards and other public benefits, I guess we'll be seeing a little bit more. We're hearing anecdotally that, for example, Social Security applications and food stamp benefits and Medicaid and things are being impacted around the country. We just haven't seen it here yet.
What she has seen is the impact of the so-called sequestration, automatic spending cuts to government-funded programs. Those took effect in January. Bruce Bennion says some of her grants have been cut by as much as 20%. Back in Boston, Abdi Raham Youssef has also seen his budget cut dramatically by the sequestration. He says it's harder to pay the rent, the electric bill, and his small part-time staff. To him, the latest government shutdown reflects a sad state of affairs in Washington.
It is possible that next year we might not be here. It's very possible. After 17 years of trying to build an institution that helps newcomers acculturate and integrate into the larger American society.
For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
The civil war in Syria has forced 2 million people there to seek refuge in other countries. Many have ended up in neighboring Turkey. That's where Zeydun al-Zuabi is right now with his family. He's a Syrian opposition activist and former university professor who's been jailed twice by the Assad government. Both times he managed to win his release. Al-Zuabi described for me the two jails he was in, including detention center number 215, where he was held with his brother.
I once called it the factory of madness and death. I used to see, like, I mean, every day for 26 days, every day, 5 to 6 people dying. Not because of torture, in fact. It was just because of the conditions we were in. There was no oxygen. There is no food. You can't sleep. There is no way to sleep because of noise and because of the congestion inside the room. Oh, my God. That is the worst place I've ever, I mean, thought of in my life or seen. I saw people inside a cage, literally a cage. You cannot recognize whose body is this head or this arm belongs to which body. Just people over each other. just watching death on a daily basis has really changed my life. My brother used to ask me, why in hell you just go and watch people who are dying? I said, they at least deserve a bit of smile just to show them that you have sympathy. You can't do anything to them. But at least tell them, oh my God, I'm with you. I wish I can help you. And again, I'm not talking about torture, because physical torture is nothing, nothing as compared to the death because of lack of oxygen, lack of sleep. And then you just watch, keep watching, I mean, your friends, one after another, including myself, losing their minds. I started seeing, I mean, I don't know, nightmares. My brother used to help me a lot. He saved my life, literally, because he used to tell me, Zaidun, you are losing your mind. Your father is not next to us. Your father has died.
Given what the world knows of the war in Syria, why were the opposition, why were you just not summarily killed?
I was about to die. But then by coincidence, I was called that day for interrogation. And then the officer sees me and says, what in hell, what's wrong with you? I said, if you just waited for 24 hours, you would have seen me with the people who are covered with the blanket and thrown away. When he saw this, he put me in a bit better place. Otherwise, I would have lost my life.
So
it is just a coincidence.
So how did you get out of the prison, and how were you able to leave Syria?
The first time I was jailed, there was an exchange of prisoners with the Iranian detainees, or POW. And then I went back to my activism, because I felt that I will not give up my fight for democracy. Then I was jailed to the second time on 30th of April. I was jailed all over, 66 days. No one was allowed to call me by name. I mean, the officers there used to call me 12. I was 12. Again, they put pressure on me, and I was released. Immediately after I released, I asked them, I want to leave the country. They said, we will allow you, but this is one permission. If you come back, you will not be allowed to leave the country.
So the people that you were in jail with, what happened to them?
The biggest trauma is the people who are inside. This is not any usual place. This is hell, literally. Marco, there was one child whose age was 3 years. They jailed his mother. They jailed his father. They didn't know what to do with him, so they brought him with them.
3 years old?
3 years old.
In jail?
In jail. That was in branch 248, in the second detention.
And was this child with his parent?
His mother was in one cell. His father was in another cell. And he used to play in the corridor and cry when he's with his mother. He wants his father. So we were just peeping at him from a small hole. And what in hell, 3 years kid.
If I asked you, Zaidun, 10 years ago, for your opinion of Assad, what would you have told me?
No, I would have told you that this guy is decent. Even one day before the revolution, by the way, and I have to be frank, I never thought of a person who's a medicine doctor, who's a physician, who was educated in the West. I've never thought of this guy to be such brutal, criminal person.
Zaidun, what kind of future do you see for your children?
That's a difficult question. Now I don't know where Mr. Assad has taken us to. I know my children might not be very much thankful for what is left of the country, but everybody has to understand it wasn't us. We wanted freedom, we wanted peace, and we wanted Syria for all Syrians, disregard of sectarian affiliation, religious affiliation. It is too difficult, Marco, to understand. But what can we do? That is our destiny.
Zaidun, thanks very much for speaking with us and for your candor. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Syrian opposition activist Zaidun al-Zuabi, he spoke with us from Istanbul, Turkey. Still ahead on the show, prom night in Cape Town. You're listening to The World from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Even by Greek standards, the past few weeks in Greece have been dramatic. It all involves the neo-Nazi political party Golden Dawn. Golden Dawn was riding high with support from austerity-weary Greeks. Then one of its members was implicated in the murder of an anti-fascist rapper. Now Golden Dawn is facing a police crackdown. More than 20 members have been arrested. And today its leader appeared in court. The World's Clark Boyd has our story.
Being called extreme, far-right, anti-immigrant, Golden Dawn's never had a problem with that. But in the past, if you called them neo-Nazis, they'd be sure to take exception. This despite the fact that a Golden Dawn anthem includes lines like, "We want a new Greece that will cover all the earth." But now, the media seem to be calling Golden Dawn what it is, a neo-Nazi party. Golden Dawn, or Chrissi Avi, as it's called in Greek, has been around since the early 80s. And for years, it stayed firmly on the fringes of Greek society. But an influx of immigrants, many of them illegal, from Africa, Asia, and the Middle East into Greece, changed that equation. A few years ago, Golden Dawn decided to stop fighting Greek leftists and anarchists. Yannis Papadopoulos is with Greece's Tanea newspaper. He spent the last 3 years reporting extensively on the rise of Golden Dawn.
They started attacking the immigrants. So in many neighborhoods, we had racist attacks. People with darker skin couldn't walk through main squares. And sadly, some people felt that this was for their own good.
Golden Dawn's xenophobic attacks and rhetoric struck an even bigger chord when austerity measures began to hammer the country. When I was there for elections last May, young voters especially turned out to support Golden Dawn. I voted for Chrissi Avi, Golden Dawn, this young man told me, because immigrants have ruined the center of Athens.
That election shows a massive political vacuum, and any kind of creature that could walk on two legs could profit from it, and Chrissi Avi did that.
Brady Kiesling is a former U.S. diplomat living in Athens. Suddenly, he says, what was once a fringe group was a political party with a significant presence in parliament. And as the economy continued to worsen, Kiesling says, Golden Dawn became all the more attractive.
There's a huge number of underemployed people in Greece, and the ones with Golden Dawn were given a social role to play that for many of them was the first vaguely positive social role they'd ever had.
Passing out food and clothes to the poor, for example, but not before checking IDs to make sure the people getting help from Golden Dawn were true Greeks. Meanwhile, anti-immigrant violence continued. Kostas Papaioannou helps run the Athens-based Racist Attack Recording Network. He says Golden Dawn has been acting like vigilantes.
When they find immigrants who are one or two people only, they go and ask them where they are from, and before getting an answer, after getting an answer, they violently attack using knives and broken bottles and chains.
But the authorities couldn't seem to pin anything on Golden Dawn. Brady Kiesling says that might be down to the alleged criminal ties between Golden Dawn and the police.
They run rackets together. They compete in other rackets. And the Greek police had been feeling deeply unloved for many years. And Golden Dawn said, "You're our guys. You know, we are the party of pimps and protection rackets, but we are also the party of the police."
Until recently, Golden Dawn was still enjoying record popularity. And then 2 weeks ago, 34-year-old anti-fascist activist Pavlos Fisas was stabbed to death by a Golden Dawn member. That led to a sudden crackdown on Golden Dawn's leadership. Why now? Again, journalist Yannis Papadopoulos.
The main factor was because the victim was a Greek man. Society cared more. It was one of them.
Papadopoulos describes what police found when they raided the house of Golden Dawn's leader, Nikos Michaloliakos.
Michaloliakos, he calls himself and they call him the Führer. He is truly and clearly a neo-Nazi. Police found in his house during his arrest a big portrait of Hitler. And they also confiscated two handguns and one pistol, for which he didn't have a license.
Papadopoulos says the recent crackdown hardly spells the end of Golden Dawn. Maybe, he says, it's the beginning of the end. For their part, Golden Dawn's members are still defiant. On leaving the courthouse yesterday, two of them shouted at reporters, "Golden Dawn forever! Get that into your heads!" Former American diplomat Brady Kiesling says that it may indeed feel like forever. The Greek justice system, he notes, moves at an agonizingly slow pace and, he says, has a terrible track record when it comes to building airtight cases against complex organizations. For The World, this is Clark Boyd.
Let's turn now to the next installment in our First Day series. And these are stories we're collecting from immigrants in the U.S. about their first days in America. Our series is inspired by Philadelphia's South Asian American Digital Archive. Today we hear from a Russian journalist who once wrote for such Soviet-era stalwarts as Pravda and Izvestia. In 1989, he moved to Boston for a journalism fellowship and ended up staying.
I'm Vladimir Voina. I was born in 1936 in Moscow. I was 53 years old when I came to America. In 1989, it was an evening. I went out on the Harvard Square corner, Italian food store with delicate, very good, all kinds of foods, showing brands of beer. And it struck me as something absolutely surreal, not possible even to imagine. I counted 83 beers. Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, because it was so unnatural. We were drinking in Moscow just one brand of beer. Beer, there were long queues after beer. Everything I saw was filling me with joy. When I got my bank book, the first in my life, I was so proud of it. I thought, this is how Americans, well, American leaders are eradicating the desire of the Americans to build socialism, communism, and all that foolish stuff. I was so proud, and I was thinking, now I am also a part of the capitalist system. Now I am too much critical about American life. I find so many things I disagree, and we are looking at the TV screen now. What was this discussion about shutdown? I find it so foolish, so irresponsible. It's all games, political games. I hate it. It's not serious. You have to create something, not to destroy. The balance between two-party system is a wonderful thing.
Russian journalist Vladimir Voina with his impressions of life in America. You can hear more First Day stories at pri.org/firstdays. And how about submitting your own story? We all have at least one tale of being in a new and unfamiliar place for the first time. Tell us yours at pri.org. Just click on the orange record button. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, photographing the veil in Yemen. And later, high school students from a township in Cape Town, South Africa, focus on their big evening out. We meet a girl who's been saving all year to buy her dress for the prom.
You have to look good. You have to look the part. You have to just, you know, have that oomph and shine.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. No sign of a breakthrough in Washington today, but as bad as the federal government shutdown may be, there's another even bigger battle looming on Capitol Hill. The U.S. is set to run out of cash on October 17th, unless Congress raises the debt ceiling by then. Richard Parker teaches at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. I asked him why the rest of the world is so concerned about what happens with our debt limit.
Because the global economy is deeply intertwined, and especially intertwined with America. At the end of the Second World War, the U.S. was half of the world's economy. Today, it's still a quarter of the world's economy. And more important, the dollar is the currency that's used in transactions around the world. Something like 80% of all commodity transactions around the world are denominated in dollars. And U.S. treasuries are considered the equivalent of the gold standard, the very best, most reliable form of sovereign debt, that is, of government debt that's issued anywhere in the world. And when other countries get in trouble or the world seems shaky for even the slightest moment, billions upon billions of dollars rush into the United States. And the United States has enormous advantages economically by having that reputation as being an unimpeachable borrower, which repays every cent that it borrows.
So just so we don't lose anyone here, basically raising the debt ceiling is like requesting a raise on your credit limit on a charge card. It would allow the U.S. government to borrow more and, I guess, spend more, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the government takes in basically taxes, but the taxes don't cover what the government spends each year. We could have an argument about whether we should raise taxes, but the difference between what a government takes in and spends is covered by its borrowing. And it borrows in the markets, and the markets price that debt, meaning they determine what the effective interest rate is that the government will pay by the creditworthiness of the government. The United States government has an exemplary credit rating because it has not ever defaulted on its debt in its entire history. And if that reputation is broken, it's going to send a shudder through bond markets, through stock markets, through global economy.
And what has happened historically when great powers do default on their debt?
Well, lots of things, which is that those great powers oftentimes discover that they're not great powers anymore. Historically, in the period of the early modern nation state, kings oftentimes defaulted on their debt. And it led to repeated crises that often were preludes to the overthrow either by new kings or by irate citizens.
You have a good illustration for us?
I mean that the French repeatedly defaulted on their debts, and the accumulated liabilities that then made the taxation of the populace even greater, of course, led to the Revolution of 1789 and the beheading of the king and his wife.
Now, officials at the International Monetary Fund say even a temporary failure of the U.S. government to pay its bills would have a catastrophic impact on the global economy. Can you unpack that for us a bit? I think most international players watching this abroad would expect that Democrats and Republicans would wrangle for a bit, but ultimately strike a deal. Why the panic?
Well, let me stand back and say, you know, the IMF is right to say catastrophe because what would flow from an unresolved debt default, a failure of the Congress to raise the debt limit, would, if not resolved, prove a real catastrophe. That is, markets would become highly unstable because people would suddenly not know what kind of world they're in or how to price the future. We could expect that stock markets would go down. We're in the midst of a fragile global recovery right now, as every American listening knows. And you could essentially throw the brakes on that recovery and actually throw the gears into reverse. In other words, we could get a major new recession out of this beginning early next year.
How nervous are you right now?
I think we've got a 1 in 3 chance that we're going to go over this cliff.
Richard Parker, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, thanks so much.
Good to talk with you.
The federal shutdown has closed a lot of museums in Washington, but here in Boston, you can still visit the privately run Museum of Fine Arts. Right now, there's an exhibit there focusing on female photographers from the Middle East. One of them is Bushra al-Mutawakkel from Yemen. And when I spoke with her recently, I asked her to describe how some of her work challenges the socially conservative rules of Yemeni society. What I'd like you to do, first of all, Bushra, some of these fantastic pieces of yours, walk me through this series of pictures where you and your daughter and her doll are dressed up in various phases of hijab and niqab, and I don't know these terms. So what are we looking at through this series of photographs, and what was your intent? What were you trying to do?
Well, this series is called Mother, Daughter, Doll. It's comprised of 9 images, and the first image has me sitting down. I'm wearing the hijab and a coat. And my daughter is sitting on my lap, and she doesn't have any hair. You know, her hair is not covered, and she's holding her doll. It's a plain, regular, bald baby doll. And as you progress through the series, we progressively become covered. She, myself, and her doll. And then the ninth and very last image, there's nothing. There's an empty chair and an empty black background.
So, I mean, my interpretation is you're going from kind of freedom to less freedom to finally you're completely blacked out. How do people in Yemen interpret this?
Some people didn't really understand it. You know, they thought, like, what do you exactly mean? Whereas I think the majority of people did understand it. And I was very, you know, happily surprised at how it resonated with so many, because it's not just the women. It's an overall way of being, of everything being haram or wrong or restrictive or, you know, shameful or... the component of the female component is just one component of many.
I mean, you're producing some pretty controversial work in a country that's fairly conservative. Tell me about your own story, Bushra. I mean, I know it wasn't easy to launch yourself into this world of photography. You faced a lot of hurdles. What was it all like, kind of becoming a photographer, a female photographer in Yemen?
Yeah, I mean, it was challenging. I mean, I never really set out to be a photographer. It just kind of happened gradually and organically. It was something I wanted to do. I wanted to learn about photography, and I took a basic black and white course when I was in college. And then when I went to Yemen, I built a darkroom.
And college, you was here in the United States for a while,
yes,
right?
Yes, at the American University. And then I... you know, I mean, I just continued. I would join in exhibits with fellow artists. And, I mean, it was wonderful. I mean, people were wonderful about my work. But I wasn't taken very seriously. I mean, my husband would introduce me at parties and say, you know, that I'm a photographer. And people would say, oh, that's nice. It's nice to have a hobby. And, you know, but the hurdles is having access to women, photographing women, finding resources, you know, like paper and... chemicals, and you know, those were the biggest hurdles for me personally.
You also had your own family to contend with. Your mother had a choice comment or two on the series of the self portraits with your daughter and the baby doll.
Yes, my mother did eventually say something, saying to me that she found it extremely strange and odd that I would exhibit photos of myself and my daughter to the public. And then I was trying to say to her, but Mom, you know, it's a work of art. It's been exhibited here and there, and a museum purchased it. And my mother said, she found that even worse. Like, who on earth, you know, would...
Was it about tradition or was it about just not getting the art?
No, I mean, she said to me, like, who on earth would sell work of themselves and their daughter? Yeah, it's just unheard of.
You had a really poetic phrase earlier that you have your own internal revolution, you know,
yes.
As far as the Arab
yes.
Spring goes, you've got
yes.
your own internal revolution.
Yes.
Can you just explain that a bit more and how many other women are also kind of experiencing their own internal revolution in Yemen?
Oh, I think, I mean, so many, because you know, the hope is in the women. If they just fled the country, it would just be a whole nother landscape.
Bushra, thanks very much for coming into the studio. It's great to meet you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You can see some of Bushra al-Mutawakkel's amazing pictures. We have a slideshow at PRI.org. Now to South Africa. All year we've been following the students attending a public high school in Cape Town. The Center of Science and Technology, or COSAT, serves low-income families in the township of Khayelitsha. It's now the spring term in South Africa, and seniors at the school recently held their prom. The World's Anders Kelto has this story of one girl and the lengths she went to for a night of glamour.
The day before the prom, Tandi went to a hair salon. She shifted in her chair in front of a mirror coated with a thin film of hairspray. I asked how she was feeling.
Nervous, kind of frightened, because if the style doesn't suit me, there are no refunds.
Tandi was getting a weave, a shoulder-length hairpiece, for the first time. She said she didn't know how she would look, and she was nearing the end of a long, expensive journey to get ready for her big night. A few days earlier, I met Tandi at her home. She wanted to show me her prom dress. She pulled it out of a closet and ran her hands over the fabric.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
It was long and silver with a purplish hue. It glittered. I couldn't help but notice the contrast between Tandi's dress and her home, a rusty three-room shack. The windows had no glass, just bedsheets stretched across, and the walls were lined with rotting cardboard. Tani's mom makes just $200 a month and raises three kids. So back in January, at the beginning of the South African school year, it wasn't clear if Tani would be able to afford the $30 ticket for prom or the cost of a dress, shoes, and jewelry.
So I thought, okay, let me plan ahead of time.
Tani came up with an idea. She started selling candy at school, which actually violated school policy.
So I guess I kind of took a risk, but a really positive risk if you think about it.
She made just 10 cents per piece of chocolate contraband. But over several months, that added up to $30. Meanwhile, her mother and her aunt scraped together another $60, and a teacher at school helped out and bought Tandi a pair of shoes. That meant she had everything she needed for prom. As Tandi told me the story, I couldn't help but wonder, why did prom matter so much? I asked Tandi. She said, partly, she just wanted to feel glamorous for a night.
I've never worn heels. I've never worn a formal dress with makeup. I've never, done makeup, actually.
And then there was the peer pressure from her friends.
We're, pep-talking one another, you have to look good. You have to look the part. You have to just, have that oomph and shine.
And she said the prom was a chance to celebrate a big accomplishment. In a few months, she will be the first in her family to finish high school. Prom day arrived. I went back to Tandi's house. Rain was dripping through the tin roof. Tandi's brother played music on an old stereo while Tandi put on her gown and 5-inch heels. Her hair fell to her shoulders, and she wore a matching silver bracelet and necklace. Her mom stepped back to look at her.
Hello, baby. You look awesome.
Thanks.
Beautiful girl. Go do it. Go enjoy yourself.
Tandi grabbed an umbrella and changed into sneakers. She stepped outside, onto the muddy roads that surround her shack. She got into a friend's car and headed to school. Outside the school's entrance, a huge group had gathered. There were students from several high schools and members of the community. As the seniors arrived, one by one, the crowd screamed wildly. It felt like a celebrity fashion show. Tandi's car pulled up. She opened the car door and stepped onto the sidewalk, her red carpet for the night.
Wow. Yes, wow.
Her classmates were clearly impressed, but other seniors weren't so fortunate. A girl in a blue dress walked by, and the crowd went silent. I asked a group of 11th grade girls why.
That dress looks cheap. Compared to the ones that we've seen before, it's just not doing it.
Clearly, looking good and wealthy was important, even in this very poor community. Tandi and the other seniors piled into a set of vans. They headed to a French restaurant in the heart of Cape Town, the setting for prom. The evening was more or less what you'd expect. A nice dinner, prawns and lamb shanks. There were toasts.
People, all look beautiful, enjoy the rest of the evening.
And there was plenty of dancing. At one point, the students and teachers all did the electric slide to an African pop song. At the end of the night, I caught up with Tandi at her dinner table. She had a huge smile. I asked how her night had gone.
It was wonderful, great, fantastic, epic, awesome. I guess you get the picture.
She said she felt like a grown-up. And it became clear why she had invested so much money and emotion in this one night. Dancing with her teachers, eating fancy food, and looking glamorous, she said this was what she wanted her future to be.
Finally, I am an adult, and I guess I've seen the woman I'm going to be when I'm older, and it's beautiful, I must say.
She took one last look at herself in the mirror. Then, along with her classmates, she boarded a van. She headed home to her leaky, tin-roofed shack. For The World, I'm Anders Kelto in Cape Town.
I love that story. You got to see Tandi getting ready for the prom. Anders has some really sweet photos. Also, you can talk to Tandi on Facebook. She'll be joined by another student we've featured in our series. You may remember 17-year-old Sive. He's the kid who lost his parents, and he's now in charge at home. Earlier this year, Sive traveled on a youth leadership program to the U.S.
It made me think about what I want to be in the future, and it made me think outside the box.
You can talk to Sive and Thandi about their futures and their current lives in South Africa. That's all at our series page, pri.org/schoolyear. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Remember when cars had ashtrays and cigarette lighters? They've all but disappeared as automakers have made room for more cup holders and gadgets. I'll bet some of you don't even know where the cigarette lighter is in your car if you have one. Well, the Korean car maker Hyundai says it's going to get rid of the cigarette lighter jack, and it's going to replace them with a USB jack. We wondered what that's about. Tech innovation, cost-cutting measure, or just a general diss of smokers? So let's put the question to Paul Eisenstein, editor of the DetroitBureau.com. Paul, what do you think is driving Hyundai's decision?
Well, clearly they don't need to have cigarette lighters and ashtrays in most cars today. Most people don't smoke in the cars. Even smokers have figured out they don't want to smell up their car. So they tend not to use cigarette lighters anymore. Getting rid of them, I think Hyundai is saying, will be savings, cost savings. They're planning to replace the cigarette lighter with USB ports, which they say would appeal to people who have more modern technology. You know, you charge up your iPhone or the like, you really don't need the cigarette lighter.
What about all those Asian smokers we hear about? I mean, this is a Korean car company. They're doing this for their Korean models. Aren't they going to miss their cigarette lighters?
I'm a little surprised, actually, that they're planning to do this worldwide, because you do still find smokers in some markets, particularly in Asia. And Hyundai is trying to gain a lot of traction in China, which has some of the heaviest smoking in the world. So I think they may get a little bit of pushback from some of their customers as they roll this plan out.
I've seen a fan that runs on a USB port. Maybe we'll start seeing retro-style cigarette lighters that have a USB jack.
For those people who need them. I have to say that I'm a little bit surprised, because there's still a lot of things that run on the old-fashioned 12-volt lighter jack, radar detectors, navigation systems. And I don't think that they can get enough power from a standard USB port. People are carrying all sorts of toys. Electronics and electrical goods have become the way of life. I've seen people plug in hair dryers, unfortunately, sometimes using them when they're driving.
No way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, unfortunately, I've seen that, makeup and what have you. You also see coolers that use the 110-volt jacks and tools and things like that. Honestly, I think Hyundai would be making a mistake if they dropped the standard cigarette lighter jack.
Yeah, I used to have this great little vanity light in the car that plugged into the jack until it got stolen. So all these little gadgets, are they all in jeopardy unless those manufacturers adapt them with a USB jack?
Yeah, I think they are in trouble if the manufacturers don't adapt. Beyond that, I think that there are some things that just need more power than you can get out of a USB jack. So I think there's going to be a lot of people that are going to say, wait a second, I need that jack.
It's funny, we're even calling this still the cigarette lighter jack, considering how many different devices people use and plug into it. When was the last time, Paul, you used a cigarette lighter as a source of fire?
Source of fire probably would have been back in the 70s, and I probably shouldn't talk about what I was using it for.
Paul Eisenstein, automotive analyst in Detroit. Thanks so much.
It's good to be with you.
We're going to start something new on the program today. We want to introduce you to the Beatmaking Lab. It's a project launched by two professors in North Carolina who are also musicians. They want to bring beatmaking, as in hip-hop beats, to communities in the developing world. Over the next few weeks, we'll be following their latest effort in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Stephen Levitin, a.k.a. Apple Juice Kid, and Pierce Freelon are the guys behind the Beatmaking Lab. Here's how they told me it all started.
Well, the Beatmaking Lab started as a class at the University of North Carolina, Stephen and my alma mater, where we teach electronic music production as a class that brings, you know, musician entrepreneurs and pairs them with academics to create this innovative curriculum where you don't need to know how to read music or know music theory or read classical music notation. You can just chop a sample and make a beat. And that developed into an international program when we piloted a collaboration with a nonprofit in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And so it kind of went from campus to Goma, East Africa. Over the past 18 months, we've been to Panama and Senegal, we've been to Fiji, and now we're most recently in Ethiopia. So it's really grown fast, and we're excited about it.
Tell me why you guys do this. I mean, it's not just about, you know, your love of hip-hop. There's more to it.
we like to make music. We like to travel. We like to have social impact in our work. It's really just a space for us to fulfill our artistic and entrepreneurial and activist desires in one program. And the Beatmaking Lab is an example of that.
And I'll just add one really brief note is that, you know, we're increasingly in a global community. You know, this mobile studio now, you can take this tool in a backpack and bring it all over the world and connect students all over the world. So for me, the cultural exchange is a really exciting aspect to this project. We've had our UNC students collaborate with our Ethiopian students. We've had our Fijian students sending beats, you know, across the world to our students in Africa. And it's been a really rich experience because the music that comes out of this, you know, MCs rapping in Swahili and French and English, you know, just kind of mashing up together, mashing up their styles.
You've been making short films about your beat-making labs. The first from your trip to Ethiopia is online today, and you listeners can see it at our website, PRI.org. Let's hear a clip from it.
My name is Delila. I live in Addis. I'm 21 years old. And I like music, so I would like to be a beat-maker.
So that was a clip from the Beatmaking Lab's first video from Addis Ababa. Now, you guys profile a woman, a young woman named Galila. She comes across in your Ethiopian film as so shy, a family girl who's concerned about her aging father. But then she just, like, comes alive the second the word music is mentioned. Tell me about Galila.
Galila is a really shining student that we had. And in every lab we go to, it's just such a fun experience to go from day one where everyone's shy, you know, where we do the icebreakers, and then by the end of the lab, everyone feels like family and we're crying when we leave. So Galila is definitely our sister in another country. You know, she's a really special person. Within the first few days, we identified her as a great, vibrant talent to have featured in our song.
I'd love to take our listeners out with some beats by Galila. Do you have any?
Yes, we have one. It's a bit of a rough mix, but I think you'll enjoy it.
All right, well, we'll go out with that. And you guys will be blogging for the world as well as sending us stills and videos of your lab in Ethiopia. And we'll also be checking in weekly with you to hear about the progress. You can see all that at PRI.org. Stephen Levitin, Apple Juice Kid, and Pierce Freelon, the men behind Beatmaking Lab. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Big thanks to our friends at Station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, for helping us out with that one. We'll hear more from Galila and the Ethiopian beatmakers next week. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We're online 24/7 at PRI.org, and we're back here on the radio tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.